Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Reptile Ramblings. I'm your host, Nate. Bryant's going to be running a little late, but he'll join us as soon as he can. And today I'm joined by Mr. Dakota Henn. Dakota, welcome to the show.
Me, I'm excited to be here. I can't wait to talk about all kinds of cool stuff.
So, Dakota, you want to get us start off on what you do? Like, what's your work about?
Yeah. Throughout the years, I've been really interested in studying amphibians, honestly, reptile and amphibian, but I focused primarily in tropical amphibians. I've done a lot of work in Costa Rica, looking at the ecology and natural history of several different species and assemblages throughout those Central and South America. Yeah, I have a pretty diverse interest. So hopefully we'll be able to cover all of that today.
Okay. And you mentioned your work was primarily in Costa Rica?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. What part of Costa Rica?
So some of my work has been in the northwestern part of the country, up in Guanacaste. And then some of my other work more towards the southern central region, in right outside of San Jose, San Gerardo de Dota, in the Telamancas. So
okay,
a little bit of both areas.
Yeah, I've been to Costa Rica once before, hope to go back someday. I have been both northwest and obviously the San Jose, greater San Jose area, because that's basically the only place you can fly in for the most part. But
right.
Were a particular group or species of amphibians you were working with in Costa Rica?
So in Guanacaste, I kind of focused on the entire assemblage. So there was about 13 different species I worked with, ranging from different bufonids, hylids, ranids. And then my work in the mountains was primarily with Craugastridae.
Rain robber frogs?
Yep. Those little water frogs.
Basically the most common thing you'll see.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, tons and tons of species. Definitely some of my favorite species of frogs belong to the Craugaster. So.
All right. And in the northwestern part of Costa Rica, what were amphibians you're looking at up there?
Like the Tungara frog, the milk frog, the cane toad or marine toad, Mexican burrowing toad, and the list just kind of goes on. So several different species.
Yeah. And what your research work, was that focused like on species dynamics or say like environmental impacts or anything like that?
Yeah. So up in Guanacaste, I spent some time looking into how invasive plants impact these amphibian assemblages. And it was pretty interesting stuff because I looked at the whole life cycle. So everything from the larvae, the metamorphs, and the adults, obviously, and how these invasive plants and their management, their active management, impact the dynamics, the species richness and abundance of these frogs in that region. So, okay.
And what were the species of invasive plant were you looking at?
Yeah, the plant was the Typha domingensis or the southern cattail. So we pretty common here in the States, mostly in the southern parts, but it's pretty invasive down in Costa Rica in the particular wetland that I was looking at.
Okay. And what were your findings on cattails' impact on the native amphibian community?
Yeah, so basically, it's pretty complex. So in this wetland, in Palo Verde National Park, it's about a 6,000-hectare wetland. It's huge. And this plant has taken over a majority of the wetland. It's very dense. It grows, basically think of a grassy field or like your lawn, and you shrink down to the size of an ant and you have to walk through it. It's very difficult to maneuver through. It kind of takes over the water areas in this wetland during the wet season, and it reduces the amount of open water space that you would typically see. So when I looked at all the different groups across the assemblage, I saw that with the adults, so the adult amphibians, I saw that the adults had a preference for the managed wetlands. So the sites that were more pristine, that were actively managed and didn't contain any of this plant. So we saw a higher species richness and abundance. Now with the metamorphs, it was the exact opposite. So we saw a lot of species richness and abundance in the in the unmanaged areas where this plant was really common. And then with the larvae, we saw, similarly to what we saw with the adults, there was a strong preference for the managed wetlands, and there was absolutely no larvae found in the areas in which this invasive plant existed, so these unmanaged regions. So a little confusing, a lot to unpack there still, but it seems that overall, managing these wetlands was good for this assemblage of amphibians in this region. So,
okay. And in the more northwest part of the country, what was the nature of your research there?
So that what I just that was in the northwestern in Guanacaste.
Okay.
I should have specified. The other one in central, in the mountains, that was looking at how there's a small species of frog called Crogaster podociferus. And until more recently, it's kind of been put into the species complex. Other researchers believe that species is actually made up of several other species. However, really hasn't been a lot of work kind of looking into that yet. There's different theories, but still like a species complex. Anyhow, so I looked at this species complex, Crogaster podociferus, and until recently, there hasn't been a huge evaluation of its range. So in the cloud forest in central Costa Rica, it's a pretty unique environment. The organisms that live there are very sensitive to changes. And as you move up a mountain, obviously the habitat's changing. So what I did with my team is we looked at different populations across this elevation and to try to get a better idea of how these animals are distributed across this range. And what we found was, previously, their range was between 1,100 to 2,600 meters elevation. And we found a 127 meter increase in this species elevation at 2,777 meters, which is pretty close to the top of that cloud forest in those mountains. I believe it's about 3,100 meters elevation in the region that we looked at specifically. So this is pretty interesting. So we wrote up something and had published it in Herp Review back in 2020. So it's been quite some time. And I mean, we could talk about this later, but we're kind of going back to this research now and looking at different hypotheses on why we're seeing this increase. So,
okay. Hey guys, just a quick reminder, we are once again sponsored by Serpentine Expeditions, a Breelands company, the purveyor of high quality herping expeditions all over the globe. As you can see here, this is awesome. Expeditions available. They actually announced a couple of really cool expeditions for 2026, including Sonora, Ecuador still open. That's been open for a while. I don't know why you guys haven't been jumping on that. Ethiopia, that has a lot of promise. Zimbabwe, Sumatra, Komodo, that's really cool. So a couple of really high-end destinations to go to check out for herping. And, yeah, just great guys to go herping with. And may I remind you that, once again, use code CK25 at checkout, and you get $100 off of your next booking with them. So $100, that can upgrade your flight in to have a bit more leg room. So, yeah, want to be a bit more comfortable when going on your herping trip, be sure to use our code at checkout. And with that, I'll get back to the episode. And for those of you who are listening, Bryant, welcome onto the show. Glad you can make it.
Hey, Ramblers. And Dakota, great to meet you. Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, I was really interested in this one, even though I was completely sidetracked by some obligations. And unfortunately, I still kind of am pulled into some further obligations. So this would me be a fly on the wall for this episode, guys. But still, the way you explained it, Dakota, is fantastic. And I'm curious, you know, you said it was quite some time ago, but where was this research and whatnot based in? Or based at, rather?
This is in Costa Rica, in San Gerardo de Dota, in the Talamanca Mountains.
Okay. Awesome. Were you anywhere near there, Nate, in your travels?
Probably drove through it, but not in the Talamanca Mountains specifically.
Okay.
So, I was mostly in the Arenal region for the most part, then, like you said, up. I don't think we were in Guanacaste. I think we're more like, what's the name of the national park? It's all the way up on like the Pacific coast on the Nicaraguan border.
You're judging my memory. I wouldn't know.
I'm trying to think of it off the top of my head. But it's like that dry seasonal forest where you find like those Central American rattlesnakes, stuff like that.
You said you're dealing mainly with cloud forest habitat type in Dakota?
Yeah, for this project, it was primarily in the cloud forest.
Yeah.
Was it kind of a catch-all 22 where it didn't matter? Were you going, studying specific genera, or was it just kind of an overall survey?
Yeah, so this was mostly an overall survey for this particular species, Crogaster podociferus. It's until recently, it's kind of been the species complex, but more specifically we just looked at that individual species, we'll say, for this particular study. So
it's the common name, like robber or rain frogs. I mean, that's such a species.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The, Crogistridae, yeah, that's like the robber frogs, rain frogs, or litter frogs.
Yeah, saw quite a few of those in Costa Rica. I think we saw a couple of them in Colombia as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, real semi-tropical loving genera.
But I was going to say, I looked at the park. It's Parque Nacional Santa Rosa. That was the national park I went to. The northwest corner. So
awesome, good deal. Well, still, don't let me steal the direction of how you were heading, Nate. And I kind of cut in late, so I'm not too sure. Are you just giving kind of a bit of a having Dakota have a bit of a brief back history on the subject matter, and I guess what brings us to present current day Dakota? What what's on the forefront now?
We're still tinkering with this project from Costa Rica in the mountains. We had a team go out within the last couple of years, and they collected a lot more data. So we're looking through that, and we have a lot of environmental data, and we're seeing some interesting things. I don't want to give it away too much yet because we're still working on the paper. But essentially what we're seeing is there's some sort of interaction happening between the prey abundance of this frog, as well as the temperature and humidity, so our abiotic variables, that are kind of shaping how these frogs are distributed along this gradient in montane forest. Because when we had originally found this range increase, we were kind of concerned, as if you see such a big range increase within mountain systems, that could be an indication that something's happening within the environment, as obviously mountain species tend to have very specific ranges and are usually centralized to very specific habitats. So that's kind of what we're at right now with that project. I've also have taken some time to look at more or less like herpetological observations with some species of birds as well, and their interactions with frogs and snakes. Those are kind of just more one-off things. So,
I mean, what were some of those one-off observers?
Yeah, and I was in Ecuador at in the Yasuni National Park, and I had spent some time out there helping out a mammalogist with some camera traps, and then I had some free time to kind of do some observations. And what I found there was there's the great black hawk, pretty large raptor species, and I had seen it and observed it eating a marine toad, and obviously those are quite toxic. So I got some pretty good notes on it feeding on this species, and it turns out that observations of bird and this toad are pretty limited, and are pretty centralized to other parts of South America, but hasn't really been observed in that national park. So I wrote up some stuff on the way that bird was consuming that toad. It was pretty interesting to watch. So out of all of the interactions that you have in a rainforest, it's always a good day when you see that happen.
And how was the hawk eating the toad? Was it?
Yes. So it had, after it had caught it, it had positioned it on its back with its belly up, and it was kind of on this big stump on a river, and it had basically scraped out all of the entrails of the toad onto the log and ate all of it, almost like it was eating something out of a bowl. So during that whole process, though, it kind of picked around the parotid glands on the toad, avoiding all of the toxins, which is cool to see, with it being so toxic, that the bird just completely avoided those glands.
I was going to say, it's kind of like how those crows in Australia have adapted to eating invasive toads by like just reaching down the throat and pulling stuff out of the toad's throat, basically.
Right. And that's why I thought it was pretty interesting, because it just kind of gives us more insight as to how predators interact with these toads, because obviously they're similar to what's happening in Australia with the invasive cane toad. And it just helps us understand different ways in which avian predators eat them. So obviously it's kind of up to nature on whether or not these animals are going to decide to eat them in Australia. But it is pretty interesting to me.
I mean, if anything's going to be dexterous enough and knowledgeable enough to learn about marine toads and then avoid the pterygoid glands, it would be birds, whether it's within, you know, cane toad's native range or not, you know, ergo with Australia not being, you know, this native range. But with the blackhawk, I mean, that's a pretty, that's a, also neotropical slash tropical species, has a pretty big range. And so it makes sense, you know, being the generalist that it is, that some of them would have some, I guess, knowledge or culture when it comes to dealing with cane toads. That's pretty cool, though, to see.
Yeah.
Pretty visceral, though, with the toad being a bowl of its own entrail.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you're working, just a little bit of work in Ecuador. What are some other Latin American countries you've done research in?
I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut in, but before that, Yasuni is very, you know, it's, I don't know what's the right word. It's not popularized, but it's well known as one of these big, you know, bio hotspots, since it's, you know, obviously preserved for others to come in. But maybe you could talk to this, Dakota, just how big and expansive the Yasuni is.
Oh, yeah. It's big. So I remember flying out there and going to, obviously, landed in Quito. And then we had to fly to a separate, smaller airport. And the name, I lose the name, but the travel from there to there was a couple hours. Then we had to board a boat to a bus to a boat to another boat. And pretty much any time we were in the water, we were within park, national park. And the travel was just, it was many hours of traveling through this national park in Yasuni. And the biodiversity there was really cool. You know, I was there for several weeks and only scratched a tiny hair of it by the field station. And I would totally go back and spend some more time there. So yeah, very expansive. Lots of things to see.
Awesome. And then obviously, of course, we're Reptile Rambling, you know, we're herp nerds here. So besides that really neat observation with the cane toad, you mentioned some Serpentes observation or saurian. Like, what were some of the more notable things you saw during your stay when it comes to, like,
yeah, so I guess out there, I saw all kinds of like whip lizards, some forest tortoises, like the yellowfoots, and related species.
There's, oh, that's real neat.
Yeah, lots of colubrids. So I'm not too familiar with the species of snakes down there. I didn't see, I saw probably about five. Some of them were like the false coral snakes. They're really cool. They had like black banding and red banding with these yellow eyes. So I got some pictures. I can forward them to you guys. Obviously, I'm a frog nut, so I saw a lot of those, especially like the Phylomedusa species, like the angle-headed white-lined monkey frog. That was probably one of my favorites. There was another group there, and they were just there for kind of more of photography of insects, which is really cool. And one night I had just missed a Sicilian encounter, which sucked, because those are cool. But I'm trying to think what else. There's the twist neck turtle, which are cool, Amazonian river turtles. So, oh yeah. Yeah, lots of different things.
Yeah. So, you mentioned Ecuador, Costa Rica. What are some other countries you've done work in or have gone herping in?
As far as Central and South America, it's pretty much just been Ecuador and Costa Rica. I've done some exploration in Namibia, and that
Okay,
was
I
really
definitely
cool.
want to ask about that.
That was really cool, although the trip wasn't necessarily herp related, and we also were there during their dry season, and they were going through a drought. So the herp activity was pretty low, but I got to see some really cool Namibian tent tortoises, or the spiny tortoise, that was incredible to see. They're a lot smaller than I would expect them to. And then, unfortunately, snake I saw was a some sort of cobra. I couldn't identify it because it was too high up in the air in the talons of a bird of prey. So that was unfortunate. But like tons of geckos and oh, what else? But mostly it was mostly like kind of your big game type mammals and birds. So
Okay. And I haven't really heard anything about what it's like traveling to Namibia, but as a country, how accessible would you say is it would it be for an American to go there for like a herping trip?
oh yeah, I had a lot of fun. It was relatively easy to get to. I didn't really encounter many issues with anything. It was easy to travel with. When we were down there, we were paired up with a basically a game preserve manager. So he manages this huge plot of land, and he manages the different basically hoof stock of that land. So we were with him. So he was able to take us out to like the Kalahari Desert, the Namibian Desert. We hit up the Skeleton Coast, and I mean, he was extremely knowledgeable on the wildlife there. And he, if I wanted to see something, he knew of a great place. So if I highly recommend, if anyone's looking for a good place to just explore in general, Namibia is a great country in Africa to do that. So I wish I could have seen more herps, but that just means I got to go again. So
Now, when me and Bryant were talking a few days ago, he mentioned he saw somewhere on profile a location in Mexico it looked like you went to.
no, I haven't spent much time in Mexico.
Okay.
I used to live in Louisiana for a while, but now I never did anything in Mexico.
Okay. So yeah, you what got your master's from University of Southern Louisiana?
Yes, Southeastern Louisiana University, right outside of New Orleans.
Okay. And what was your don't mind me asking, what was your thesis on?
Yeah, the thesis was the work that we kind of talked about before about the invasive wetland plants, and then the amphibian assemblages. So that was a great project, and I'm still working on it. There's lots to still uncover there, but that was a blast, and it was nice because when I wasn't sampling, I was able to kind of go out and do some herping and exploration. I can kind of touch on that if you want.
You know what? Just before that, I do, and I'm so sorry, Ramblers. I do want to back to Ecuador because that was quite a refresher. Just what you guys touched on beforehand, and you mentioned research station, and that was the connection I made with Nate at one point in our chatter. That I looked into that very same research station because it is situated in just a fantastic spot within the Yasuni. I mean, like you said, you have to take multiple boat rides and whatnot to even reach the damn place. I mean, it's one of those on the frontier kind of a place, you know, it's very cherished. I guess anything at night, obviously, with amphibians, you know, you got your smorgasbord, I guess crocodilians, like some caiman on the side.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, lots of black caiman.
Yeah.
That was really cool to see.
Yeah, it seems like that's kind of like their stronghold over there. That's just awesome.
Yeah, the field station I stayed at was the Tipitini Biological Station. And while I was there, they are starting to allow, from my understanding, more like outside visitors, if you will. It historically used to be more just for researchers, but I know in more recent times they've been trying to open it up to birders, herpers, people that just want to experience that park and the wildlife there. So I think if anyone's looking for a place to check out, definitely check out that field station.
100% Ramblers. And also, contact wise, they're reasonably easy to get in contact with, because not last year, 2024, some friends and I had actually considered going out there in summer. And so I had contacted them, and, you know, it was relatively easy to chat with them about, you know, what our goals were, basically our loose itinerary. And, you know, none of us are really academic based. We just have that kind of naturalist orientation. But yeah, I would reiterate, they're a great place to check out as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know they have a very detailed website, so I can always send that to you guys too, and they have all of that good information on the travel and kind of what they do for the itinerary. So yeah, definitely.
Have you done any research work in the United States?
Yeah. So when I was at Southeastern, a group of us did some work on green frogs. So what we looked at was, there's a lot of wetland assimilation sites. So right outside of New Orleans, there's one big one. And for those who are listening that don't quite know what a wetland assimilation site is, essentially, whenever you flush your toilet, take a shower, all of that water gets put into a treatment site, and we know that. Well, the treatment process can only take out so much of what goes in there. So a lot of times what happens is, when people take some sort of medication or drugs and they excrete it, it's very, very either expensive or just almost impossible to extract certain things from the water. Well, the wetland assimilation site, the water gets put back into the environment, which is great. But unfortunately, sometimes these compounds are put into the sites. Now, they're often very nutrient-rich sites. So there's a lot of foliage, and it's really good habitat for lots of animals, fish, frogs, and in case down there, like crocodilians. So what we wanted to look at was how these compounds, the wastewater effluent, were impacting the green frogs in this wetland assimilation site. So we had gone out there, collected quite a few individuals, both male and female, and we extracted their gonads, and we were able to look at them under a slide. It's a very long process. Look at them under a slide to look and see how these effluents are affecting the developmental growth of these frogs.
I'm so tempted to just quote Alex Jones right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, you know. So we were looking at that stuff, and we did see that in the male frogs, they were producing like oocytes in their testes, and it was evident. So this work is something that's kind of an ongoing thing down there. So there's obviously other students that are working on it. Needs a lot more attention, but it was really cool to work with that group and start that up. There's been another group that looked at Poecilid fish, so like kind of your mosquito fish and stuff, and that's also kind of being compounded as well. But that was some really interesting work down there, and to be a part of that was really it was a great opportunity to learn about how those compounds are affecting the amphibians out there. Now, this is just looking at one particular location, but there's plenty and plenty of examples of where the wastewater effluent is put back into the environment. So not saying it's necessarily a bad thing, but it does have some sort of impact on at least the amphibian life from what we see.
My God, Alex Jones was right after all.
That's too funny.
Do you do it other research work besides the gay frogs in Louisiana?
So the as far as that, it's kind of where I'm at right now. A lot of these projects are just kind of ongoing. There's some new stuff in development with some collaborators at the university. But it's kind of right now at the starting point, so I don't really have too much to say on that. But the goal is right now I'm in between programs. So I recently graduated with my master's. I've been working on some of these publications, which some of them I had published last year in 2025, and then working on some now. But the goal is I'm looking into like PhD programs, other avenues like that that I'm hope to pursue. So it's kind of it's been a lot of different things. I've kind of put my hands in a lot of different things to, yeah.
I'm curious, but since you were in Louisiana for some time, what were you ever curious in going over to like Mississippi, Alabama, some other Mississippi alluvial plains states?
Yeah, we I had some buddies of mine, and we'd go to Mississippi a lot, and yeah, and Alabama, and do some mostly in Alabama, like coastal, and we do some herping for a lot of different like salamander species, which is really cool. I really love like the Nectaris and our mud salamanders, red mud salamanders. Those are just so cool to me. So yeah, a lot of fun. And then we spent a lot of time just kind of exploring Louisiana in general. There's lots of areas and boardwalks to just catch Nerodia and get bit up and musk done. So
Okay. A bit of a change in pace, but I noticed you got a couple of terrariums set up behind you. I think I've seen a little bit of movement behind them, in them.
yeah.
So, what all do you keep?
Yeah, so I've kept a lot of different animals over my life. I've quite a few right now. I have about 65 different species. And they range from like tarantulas, different other inverts. I really have a sweet spot for lizards and keeping lizards and keeping amphibians. So behind me, I got a bunch of tarantulas. I got a salmon bird eater in this tank here. And then I have rose hair tarantula, curly hair, orange bamboo tarantula in these enclosures. I got a classic bearded dragon in the big enclosure there. I keep some dart frog species, different toads and frogs. I recently had acquired a crested toad, South American crested toad, which is super cool. Looks like a leaf. Red-eyed tree frogs. What kind of actually got me started into reptiles and amphibians is when I was like about 4 or 5 years old, my parents bought a Mali Euromastic lizard. And that was kind of my way that I would go to school because I didn't like going to school as a child. And I would basically, this lizard I could bring to school to use in show and tell, and I could talk about it. And it's really cool because all these years later, I actually still have him, and he's in another enclosure in my room. And yeah, he's an old man, but I love the Euromastics. I got a couple of them. So,
well, I mean, they're like the most tortoise of all the lizards, right? You know, there's an ancient way about them.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and they're extremely personable. I don't think people give them enough credit, in my opinion. So,
have you ever thought about going over to where wild Euromastics are to try and hurt them?
Oh yeah, absolutely, dude. I would love to. I've seen. I'll browse on like on the internet. On herping pages, or just kind of look on iNaturalist and see what people are seeing. And yeah, people see some really cool things. I really love the ornates. I'd love to see those in the wild. Those colors are so vivid. I've been kind of dabbling in photography and get some good pictures of them in their natural habitat would be fun.
Agreed. Yeah. You know, I would say when it comes to saurians, obviously I love a classic monitor or teid lizard, but I also do love the Abronia, and, you know, kind of akin, well, it's kind of inversely akin to Euromastic in that, you know, there are many species that are quite colorful, but as opposed to being, you know, subterranean or like arid species, this is a cloud, you know, cloud forest, montane species. Or genera, so it's kind of funny that trajectory, but yeah, that's
oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, were you ever in range of Abronia in your near tropical travels?
Not that there was I never encountered any, unfortunately. So, which is too bad because they're cool.
Yeah. Maybe one I probably would be interested in having my hand at, like, keeping wise. I think they'd be neat saurian. Like, they're almost perfect in that they don't really require like high heat. Like, they don't get terribly large. I guess it would just be ventilation and maybe temps. That'd probably be the only constant thing you have to worry yourself with.
Right. Yeah. On quite a couple of years ago, I acquired a pair of emerald tree skinks, and I love those things. And within the last couple of years, they were dropping eggs in the enclosure, and I tried everything I could to, you know, incubate them, but the first couple of clutches, they just nothing worked. And a couple months ago, they had dropped a clutch or two clutches, and I was able to successfully incubate those, and they hatched, and I was ecstatic because kind of being a part of that process was a lot of fun. And I don't really see emerald tree skinks available as often as I did before. So it's kind of nice to be able to have some captive bred ones at home. So
yeah. And my bad name, but I see that. Are you originally based in Illinois? Because I went back to your account a while ago, and I remember that we follow each other for quite a number of years now. But yeah, I
guess. I'm from northern Illinois, kind of 45 minutes northwest of Chicago in the suburbs.
Yeah, man, because when you mentioned Nicturus, it's like, oh, man, are you one of the lucky few to have seen one in the state? I have not yet in Illinois.
I wish I've seen them in Illinois. I've looked, but I've yet to see them. I know that they're occasionally they pop up out of Lake Michigan in Chicago. But the Nectaris that I've seen are all the southern species. So like Bayer.
Yeah, I mean, that's the more approachable and for at least for me, realistic species to look for, just because, you know, up here, Nectaris's breeding season is finishing up, but it will be less easier to spot, but they're not as easy to spot to begin with, you know? And
right.
It's just usually when they're out in the valley is when it's pretty cold, and I'm just like, I'm out of herp season by then. I'm also birding.
But I've heard of stories of people in my area, in the county, and they've a lot of ice fishermen up here, and I've heard stories of them pulling them out of different rivers when they're ice fishing, and
yeah.
I don't go ice fishing, so I guess my chances are pretty low.
Slim to none, man. Slim to none.
Man, can you imagine you're out with your buddies ice fishing? They're asking, "What are you doing?" "I'm herping."
Yeah. Which is yeah.
Yeah, he's like, "What a nerd! Go get some crappie or something, some walleye, rather." You know.
I used to, so for my undergrad, I was at Olivet Nazarene University, which is right outside of Kankakee, Illinois. And there's quite a few good herping spots there for race runner lizards, blue racer snakes, bull snakes. And man, I miss being down there, because in the spring, early spring and summer, I would encounter like bull snakes breeding on the trail. I've got some good like photographs and footage of that. And then,
I'm glad you brought that up, because you had a great observe of like, yeah, a pair of bull snakes. And obviously this is kind of common with colubrids, but not commonly, I would say, photographed. It's like, you know, their male's breeding tendencies, which is like, you know, slightly or heavily biting the female's neck.
Yeah.
And just getting into a position like that, mounting her.
Yeah. I have like quite a bit of footage of that, and I've been meaning to like put something together and like actually have like a nice video like with all of that. It's just been crazy, so I haven't had the time, but
no, it's life, man. But yeah, I highly recommend all the ramblers to go to his IG page. Fantastic observes all the way.
Oh yeah.
I mean, you touch on, you know, your neck of the woods in northern Illinois. Up there, you know, they're restoring a lot of oak savannas, because even though we're the prairie state, we had pretty decent percentage of forests and prairie, obviously, and savannas, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate, though, about how little oak savanna there is left. And that's honestly where I've seen the most, you know, herp action are in those oak savannas. It's just so sad that that's not as common as it used to be.
it is, but it seems like, you know, obviously there are many coalitions or organizations that are starting to put in the work. And, you know, what's nice is that we are starting to recover, and it seems like the percentages of, you know, Illinois' wilderness is going up. It's going in the right direction. It's just, slow. It's slow and tedious compared to others.
Yeah, I mean, just right outside, like a couple miles down the road from my house, in my county, they're doing two pretty big reintroduction programs with Blanding's turtles and smooth green snakes. So, that's really cool. The Blanding's turtles, it doesn't surprise me as much because I feel like those are, in terms of conservation programs, pretty common. But the smooth green snake in those programs, to me, is I'm always shocked because I wouldn't expect that, honestly. So it's nice to see.
Yeah, conservation efforts for a Midwestern snake, it's definitely not common. But for this species, for people that don't know, it doesn't warrant it. I mean, their population is so interesting how it's pretty disjunct. When you look at the meta populations across the state, it's they're a peculiar snake. I have not seen them yet. I'm hoping to see them within the coming months here, up by kind of your county or surrounding counties. See what I can do.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm itching to get out. So.
Yeah. Oh, cold. I mean, in the winter. Oh, so you're somewhere where it's cold. I mean, are you still based in the southeast, or are you still up here?
No, I'm back up in northern Illinois at the moment.
Okay. Well, yeah, man, it's cold, but still, it's judging from your apparel, man, it's not that bad anymore. We're going through a little bit of a warm spell, which is nice, and you know, this is one of the more normal winters we've had in a while, which I appreciate, but obviously, yeah, it was freaking cold earlier, but we're close to March. We're almost there.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it greatly reduced the tick population.
Oh yeah. That would be nice.
That would be, dude. I don't need to be reminded of ectoparasites right now. Bad news.
Yeah.
So, as a frog guy, is there a particular frog that you've enjoyed finding the most in the wild?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I've been asked that a lot, and it's so hard to answer.
It's got to be the bird voice tree frog. Come on.
The bird voice. Oh man, yeah, absolutely, bird voice tree frog. Yeah, gray tree frogs everywhere.
Crown tree frog.
Crown tree frog. I honestly, when I get asked that, I would say for me, I really, really liked seeing the Mexican burrowing toad or Rhinophrynus dorsalis. That was a frog that was a part of my master's work, and they're just like, they're so cool. They're just like big fat orange and purple blobs, and they only come out for a couple days out of the year from the ground to breed. And they make this like ridiculous sounding call. And yeah, they're just such a goofy frog. I really like those. Just because, yeah, it's kind of a rare sight. And their ecology is just whack. So I'd say, like, out of like the stranger frogs, that frog. Otherwise, I'm a sucker for, gray tree frogs, Cope's gray tree frogs, kind of your staple here in the Midwest. Even down south, we see them. I just love how personable they are. They're loud. They're everywhere. They just don't care, you know. Oh man, what would be another one?
Well,
it's a hard thing to answer.
I'm curious, with the Mexican burrowing frog, did you see them, what, in the States or out of?
So I've seen them only in Costa Rica, but I know that their range does expand up into really southern Texas. I would love to see them in the States. I just haven't gotten a chance to get down there during their activity.
I feel like Brian's just about trying to advertise another RGV herping trip.
Almost any chance I get, but I always try to connect it back to the RGV. It's just a great region in our state, you know.
Our state,
or I mean, our nation. You know, herp wise, avian wise, amphibian wise, it's great. It's great. But that's awesome. You got to see them in Costa Rica, which is obviously a bit more favorable given that once you go further south, the range is a bit more expansive.
Right. And I even got to see their larvae,
oh, wow.
Which were pretty, they were in my transects, which was awesome. And they just looked like little catfish with the big barbels. So.
Oh, that's cool. So odd.
But yeah, I don't know. It's so hard to pick. I have so many favorite frogs, you know. Seeing like red-eyed tree frogs is always a pleasure. The Phylomedusa, really cool. Like look like little aliens. They're big eyes. So many cool things.
I mean, obligatory, the smoky jungle frog. It's got to be up there, right? You guys.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, those are cool, too. I've caught a couple of those, and they're big. They make bullfrogs. Yeah. They make the American bullfrog look like a little wimp.
Like a green frog or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
They make the bullfrog look like a green frog. That's that description.
That'd be intimidating. Jeez.
But. Brian, did I ever show you the picture of the one smoky jungle frog I managed to catch in Costa Rica?
You know, you may have, but it's been a while.
But I swear that I have, and now I have the picture to prove it. That frog had a pair of nipples on its chest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I swear.
You sure there weren't like freaking ants just attached to it that have been like parasitized to cling onto the skin? You never know.
Let me see if I can send the picture to you.
Well, I'm curious, Dakota, when you handled it, you know, they are known to not squeeze, but they do ooze a bit, or they can. Some skin, like toxic skin secretions, like it's irritating.
Yeah. 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 Usually when I see them, it's in some sort of waterway. So I've always just kind of used the mud and whatnot to kind of rinse my hands off, you know. I hasn't been an issue with me yet. So but
good, yeah. The only reason I ask is that once you get to like those kinds of dimensions on a frog, I would imagine that if they do start secreting on you, it can kind of get to maybe varying levels of irritation or actual inflammation or something like that, something secondary.
Yeah, no, I've always been like pretty cautious of making sure I get, you know, whatever I got on me off. Because
you know, toads are relatively easy. You know where the secretions are coming from. With frogs,
right.
it's all over.
Yeah, yeah. It's all over their body, so you gotta, no matter where you're grabbing them, it's, you're going to be touching them, so.
Yeah. And also to confirm, Ramblers, Nate did send me in that pick. Holy crap. Oh, Nate, that's...
I just sent it to you too, Dakota.
Let's see.
Yeah. That frog legit has like a dad bod, you know. This is a superior form right here.
Oh my goodness. Oh, that's hilarious. That's funny. That's a quality picture right there. I'm surprised you don't have that printed out.
Yeah, look at the freaking Popeye burly chested specimen that Nate has caught, who is also a burly chested guy himself. So it's like double whammy.
Oh man. Yeah, it's always cool. I love seeing whatever I can out there. And the thing that kind of, it's always, when I'm out there, I'm always very like focused on whatever I'm trying to see, like whatever my study species is or assemblage. So it's always, it's like a treat when you see something that you're not like looking for. Like when I was doing my master's thesis, I was walking back from my tadpole surveys, and I decided to cut through some of the tall grass instead of taking the path, and I had stumbled across a huge black-tailed crebo. And
whoa,
that was I'm embarrassed to say, but I attempted to catch it, and it got away. It pooped all over me, slipped out. But the thing, it had to have been at least 5 to 6 feet, if not more. It was big, and it went under a tree stump where there was a hole, so it must have lived in that burrow. So I didn't want to reach my hand down there because I don't know what else is down there.
It was creepos cool. Down there. Yeah, if a creepos down there, odds are there's not a venomous snake down there.
Yeah, you shoot them all out.
Well, it's hard to use logic at the time, I would think, but
yeah,
that's too it's too bad it gave you a parting blow and then dipped.
Yeah, I waited there for a while to see if it'd come back out, but it didn't. So
that is awesome. You know, obviously we're big Kaluber fans here, and I love Dry Marking, so any chance to hear or to see, you know, is always great. So that's nice. Is that like your first introduction with Dry Marking, like your first encounter seeing them?
That was my first encounter in the wild. I keep Texas those. I have just one right now. But yeah, I used to have a pair of them, and they were they're super cool. The one I have right now is an amazing animal. Definitely not as big as what I saw in, you know, the crebo I saw, but the personality on him is awesome. So it's cool to see black-tailed crebo down there.
Yeah. Well, you know, Nate, regarding the show you did with Zach, and you guys were discussing a little bit of Dry Marking, it is true, you know. I've always thought of them as like these like real big, souped-up, confident, racer-esque snakes, because they are very similar body type-wise, yada yada. Just, you know, Dry Markings obviously have a bigger head and are bigger overall, but they're
I guess the comparison I've come up with is Coach Whip on TRT.
Yeah.
TRT.
That's a good comparison. Yeah, they're cool. I was a little disappointed I couldn't catch it, but, you know, can't catch everything.
No, you can't, dude. That's neat. What about boas? You know, you get some boas in your travels. So like Costa Rica or
Yeah, boa constrictor, I've seen quite a bit. One of them I saw, it was a couple days after the crebo encounter. That was a really gorgeous one, and I'm surprised I even saw it. It was like perfectly camouflaged with the kind of the rocky outcropping, the thing was pretty feisty, but beautiful snake. Beautiful snake. Also trying to think of what else, other boas. Tree boa, Amazon tree boa down south. That was really cool. So
any anacondas?
No, unfortunately no anacondas. So we looked for it. The issue that we were having when we were looking, it was pretty late into the rainy season, and everything was flooding. So we couldn't get our boat into some of the areas where they were hanging out. It was just too dense. So we didn't encounter any, which sucks.
Yeah, they're just more dispersed at that point, right? You know, with everything being inundated.
Yeah.
Billy, you got your mind came at them, man. I would say, obviously, a big green anaconda is a major target, but the black caiman might edge that out, at least anecdotally for me. You know.
Yeah, the black caiman, spectacled caiman I've seen, to kind of go back on the stuff in Costa Rica, the one of the biggest problems I encountered while sampling was, obviously, I'm in a wetland, and this wetland is actually pretty famous in its crocodilian population, the American crocodile. It's got a pretty dense population of American crocodiles at in Palo Verde. And they feed off of the Tempisque River. So a lot of the really big individuals will move into the Tempisque River out from the wetland. But as the wetland fills, those crocodiles become more common. So I started off in the beginning of the wet season, and towards the end of my field data collection, the water was really deep. So when I'd go out there, whether it be the day or night, I would often see them very close. Sometimes I would kick them because I'm walking, you know, in the mud, and they would kind of, they're smaller ones. So they would, I would step on them and they would jump up and I didn't see them. And so, yeah, you do what you do. You just stand there and you wait until they kind of swim off. Obviously, I'm not doing it on purpose. It's just there. But it's really cool. So as time went on, these things got bigger and got a little bit more dangerous. So I had my whomper pole that I would use to kind of poke around in the mud in front of me as I'm doing my sampling to make sure that I don't step on any more and get too close to them. It was really cool. I have a really cool picture. I don't know if it was on my Instagram, but I have a really cool picture of one day I was doing my tadpole surveys in the mornings, and then obviously my adults and metamorphs at night, and I have a picture of a crocodile, and on its tail is a larva of a frog, a little tadpole. this is kind of funny. I'm just standing over this crocodile, and there's my study species hanging out.
It sounds really concerning. You're gonna have to tell Nate and I the exact time and place you were at.
That's awesome. So, yeah, it was really cool. So, definitely at night, startling when I didn't see them and I would walk over them because I wasn't expecting it. So, you know, but it's fun.
Yeah, we love our cutest. Nate, have you dug up that article? I know I haven't, to see if the cryptic speciation has come to fruition. Like they're split. They've got to be.
I haven't had the time to yet either.
They've got to be. I'll probably try later tonight. But they're an interesting species complex, if it is true. That's awesome. Just chomping on crocs, trying not to get chomped.
Yeah. But yeah,
kind of like those famous stage photos of like white tree frogs on a back of a juvenile salty.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess they actually do that.
They're not posed. Wow.
So one question we always make sure to ask is, what's one place that's kind of your dream place to go herping someday? Like, if someone said, wrote you a blank check for your greatest herping trip of your life, where would you go?
Oh, man. Let me think about that for a second. Man. It would be between either Peru, Colombia, or Australia. If I'm looking more for amphibian life, I would say Colombia. I would really love to go out towards that that direction. So lots of cool dendrobatids, lots of cool hylids, and obviously like the terrestrial litter frogs I'd love to see out there. So yeah.
our one piece of advice, don't go in April.
why not in April?
Very tail end of the dry season.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, unless you're in the right spots, but yeah, if you don't really know for sure what you're doing, you're going all over, it's might be a whirlwind. You know, I do want to reflect just slightly back to your captive herps. You said you had a crested toad, and you said was it South American? You said
yes. Yeah.
So would that, see, you know, obviously, would that be in Ranella, like with all the other?
With all the other ones.
You know, because I guess they call them litter toads, and you may have touched on it. They're in Ranella as well, and like they're like pretty tiny toads, but they also kind of have. It seems like a lot of South American Ranella toads just have interesting crest formation, from what I've seen.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's a picture of one I have, and it was it had a pretty big crest, and the thing was eating bullet ants off a tree. Which was cool.
Wow.
So it was sitting at the base of a tree, and there was a bunch of bullet ants on the tree. I just was watching it for a while, pick them off. So, but that crest on it, it looked like bunny ears.
Bunny's ears while having like a 9-year-old stomach. That's just pretty badass.
I was going to say, Latin Americans can handle their spice a lot more than us gringos, but even their frogs can.
All right. Yeah.
Oh, dude. But yeah, no.
Well, obviously, we're a little biased. We would say, yeah, maybe veer more on that Columbia side in terms of your where the herp list, but pretty solid with Peru as well. You know, in close conjunction, and then Australia. It's like always be the mecca for most of us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, lots of cool things to see. It's been a lot of fun to be able to kind of dip my hands in a bunch of different projects. I would say my main interest is really just how are amphibians being impacted by some sort of change, and how does the environment, you know, basically impact how these animals exist? So it's been like really nice to be able to kind of look into those different factors over the years. And I aim to continue to keep doing that as time moves on. So.
All right. And out of curiosity, with your experience in the Neotropics, which habitat do you prefer herping in? Do you prefer herping in more like the upland areas, cloud forests, or do you prefer going lower elevation?
As much as I love the cloud forest, I would say the lowlands have been a lot of fun. So there's some really great species up in the cloud forest, but the lowlands, you get a lot of the like lizards and snakes and things, and it's great to see a little mix of everything. So
you don't got to hold back, Dakota. You seem like you're a wetlands guy. You know, I mean, they're amazing ecosystems. So
yeah, I love the wetlands, and obviously being down living down south for a while, lots of wetlands there too. Not Central America, but very diverse. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of why I mentioned, like, you being Louisiana, Mississippi. I mean, wetlands galore. I guess one more piece to add, since you know, you've seen Nycteris, and you said you've seen sirens as well. Have you also seen, like, their predators, like, mainly Ferantia, like mud snakes or rainbows?
Oh, yeah. I cruise up mud snakes, all the time. Super cool.
That's it.
Yeah, and mud snakes, amphiumas, really bizarre animals. So.
Yeah, the South is the Deep South has been calling my name for a while. I might have to do something about that, but that's awesome, man. Where do you see? Obviously, you guys are still continuing the research in Colombia or Costa Rica, you said, but where do you see yourself trying to integrate maybe other projects in, say, other countries? Would Colombia or Peru be up there in terms of?
I'd love to. There's some projects I'm thinking about with looking into more of like the movement ecology of these animals. So how are they specifically interacting within their environments and moving between reproductive sites? How are they foraging, things like that? And then kind of looking more into definitely like cloud forest. I really like that idea across like a gradient, just because the habitat does change so much. Kind of continuing with that, the wetland study, I definitely want to continue as well. There's tons and tons of wetlands here in the States too that are full of invasive plants like Phragmites. And a lot of the studies that have looked at that have been pretty much centralized to the north. I'd like to maybe move that kind of down south, see what's going on down there.
Well, to touch on Phragmites, maybe you've talked about it, but obviously, besides being a choke hold on wetlands, I mean, has there been other research regarding, Midwest amphibians, like, and its impact on them?
So there's let's see. There's a couple studies looking at like various toads, species of toads, and it seems that it really depends on the reproductive preferences of certain toads, or I mean some species of frogs, but it seems that if you are a specialist species, and we would expect that, I would say, if you're a specialist species, the these plants that are kind of choking out these open water areas, they aren't really great for them. They've seen a reduction of offspring, and then there's also some, not necessarily with Phragmites, but the plants, the lichens from the decaying plants may affect some amphibians as well, the water quality. So it's kind of, it really, it's very dicey. So it depends on who you're looking at and where you're looking at. So.
Unfortunately, I am going to have to dip out on you guys, but this was fantastic episode. I'm definitely going to have to run it back to hear the beginning part of it, but this was great to meet you, Dakota. I think just from our talk with you, we're always going to have you back on. You're such an interesting fella, and you're also part of the Midwest crew, so we
Well,
have
it's very
that
nice
going
to
on.
meet you. It's very nice to meet you. Thanks for talking with me today.
Well,
It's been our pleasure.
yeah. So
Yeah, thank
I
you
dip
guys.
out. I mean, you can wrap it up, Nate, or continue on if you want. I'm gonna have to dip out. We'll talk later off air. But ciao for now, Ramblers. I will see you on the next one. Bye, guys.
See ya.
And I also have some stuff I need to get to at some point tonight, so. All
Yeah, no worries. No
right.
worries.
Well, thanks for coming on, and as always, Ramblers, we will see you on the next episode.
Thanks for having me.
It's been my pleasure.